Thank you for listening to the Resources for Integrated Care podcast series, Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and Behavioral Health, Leveraging Person-Centered Approaches. This podcast is excerpted from a webinar presented live on September 27th, 2023. In this podcast, Dr. Andrea Whitwer, Associate Professor at The Ohio State University, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health, and the Director of Training and Outreach at the Neisonger Center, University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, shares about intellectual and developmental disabilities and behavioral health management complexities.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today as we talk about this really important topic. I'm going to start on the next few slides and talk about the background and prevalence. Just really, why is this an important topic that we should be discussing? We think about the prevalence of intellectual and developmental disabilities as well as mental health conditions. We know there's an estimated 7.39 million people in the United States that have some type of intellectual or developmental disability as of 2019, with more than 70% of them being children. When we look at the prevalence of intellectual and developmental disabilities among adults, we estimate it at 7.9 per 1,000. When we look at it in comparison then, when we look at mental health conditions, we see that those prevalence rates of co-occurring intellectual and developmental disabilities with mental illness, there's a really wide variability, but what we do know is that they're higher in those with IDD as compared to those without an intellectual and developmental disability. So rates of mental illness among people with IDD vary from 10 to 60%, averaging somewhere around 30%, compared to 8 to 18%. So this is definitely something that's disproportionately impacting adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Same when we think about autism. Autistic individuals have a 5.2 times greater odds of having at least one psychiatric diagnosis compared to those without any type of developmental disabilities. And even compared to their peers with intellectual and developmental disabilities, they have almost a 2 times greater odds of having at least one psychiatric diagnosis. Well, so we think about why is this? We know that adults and individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities across their lifespan are more likely than those without disabilities to experience a lot of risk factors for mental illness. This includes, but isn't limited to, stressful family experiences and situations, stigma, abuse, neglect, unemployment, and lack of supportive friendships. They also experience trauma and develop post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms from traumatic events. They're more likely to have an undiagnosed psychiatric disorder and to receive psychiatric medications without a psychiatric corresponding diagnosis. They're also more likely than people without disabilities to experience hospitalization for an adverse medication event. When we look specifically at the research related to dually eligible individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, one study looking at those dually eligible individuals found that almost 59% had at least one mental health condition. So this is a group with a highly disproportionate number with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Another study found that any primary psychiatric diagnosis and a claim for an adult with IDD resulted in a 40% greater risk of having an ER visit as compared to those without a primary psychiatric diagnosis. Another data review found that individuals categorized in the top 10% of persistently high healthcare spending were more likely to have an intellectual and developmental disability compared to those who only occasionally had high healthcare spending. So this is very important. We have this interaction of mental health paired with this group that already is at risk for these persistently high healthcare spending needs. And these data just really emphasize the importance that we're meeting mental health needs of these individuals. We think about those potential impacts of mental health conditions beyond emergency room visits, which we've talked about. We also see increased parental and caregiver stress, increased use of psychotropic medications, and poorer long-term outcomes and functioning in general. We also see an increased risk for exclusion, which can be compounded for people with behavior labeled as challenging, such as self-injury and aggression. We see these individuals may be left out of community services. They may be placed in larger scale congregate or secure accommodations and may be subjected to abuse and restricted practices. So lots of widespread impacts of mental health. So how do we navigate the system? What are the experiences that adults with ID and care providers have in working within the system? We know that often in states, the mental health and the DD systems are not always integrated. Often they're in separate locations. And so this poor integration between behavioral health and physical health symptoms and DD systems really causes it to be really difficult to meet those complex healthcare needs. It can often lead to a poor integration, and this poor integration can lead to a lack of awareness among providers within the system. What we'll often hear is that the IDD system and the mental health system each perceive that there are more resources available within the other system. So it's this idea of not maybe knowing the other system to know what resources are available. We often find IDD providers may lack that mental health knowledge to really meet those needs and identify the sources of behavioral and mental health treatment. Then we often, on the other side, will see mental health providers that could exclude adults with ID just based on their intellectual and developmental disability diagnosis, preventing access to things like intensive outpatient or group therapies. We did some work within our state asking the perspective of providers on what this siloing of systems, what some of the results are. And what they shared with us was that the ways to get mental health and DD systems to work together would be useful. So if we could really find a way, this one provider shared, it's sad that after all these years, we still have people who are in the wrong system. Mental health says their issues are developmental disability, and developmental disability says their issues are mental health, and we have folks that are stuck in the middle with limited help. Another shared, it's hard to find someone who's comfortable with both mental health and IDD. Usually it's one or the other, despite the fact that very little changes in terms of treatment of these individuals. So I feel like it's just training to become more comfortable that's necessary. Another shared, mental health seems unwilling or lacks the time, which I think is an important piece, to work with me or to attend team meetings where their expertise is invaluable to the team, which I think then goes into that last quote, which is where those direct support care staff need to have access to behavioral health consultations, so they're making sure that they're meeting those mental health needs of adults with ID and individuals with ID when they're working with them on a daily basis. We also talked to adults with intellectual developmental disabilities, and they shared their insights, really talking about the value of providers collaborating and working towards a common goal and the benefits of inviting family and other supporters and team members to appointments. The one gentleman shared, I think it's a big thing when they all talk together. They all know what can be the issue, so they can work together to a solution, being able to work from the mental health, from the DD side. You know, so everyone's not trying to do different things, right? Let's have a cohesive team that can work towards that common goal. And we heard many examples of how that does work, and these adults shared valuing that very much. We talk about the challenges with the systems, but let's talk a little bit about how do we identify mental health conditions in this population and what does treatment look like? We want to think about how we identify mental health conditions. So prior to initiating treatment, mental health conditions had to be identified. We can't get folks the help that they need if we aren't able to identify it. And what's really important here is that the data and information need to come from a whole team approach. We need to get information from the individual themselves, talk to their parent or caregivers, providers, educators or the work staff at their work placement, and other support professionals, really working together to understand if there are changes in the individual's behavior, mood, et cetera, so that we can start to work towards identifying those mental health conditions. The problem is there are challenges on that basic level of identifying symptoms. Diagnostic overshadowing is a negative bias that impacts a clinician's judgment regarding co-occurring disorders in individuals who have an intellectual and developmental disabilities. It occurs when a health professional, or really any professional, makes an assumption that a person with IDD's behavior is part of their disability without exploring factors such as that it might be due to a mental health or a biological determinant separate from that individual's disability. So really what happens is that psychiatric symptoms in this diagnostic overshadowing concept are all attributed to the developmental disabilities. In addition to identifying it getting in the way of identifying psychiatric conditions, it can also get in the way into how the case is conceptualized and the treatment planning that goes on. So here's a case example to just kind of help illustrate what happens with diagnostic overshadowing. So we had a referral for a young woman who was 18 years old, who was referred for diagnostic clarification. She was referred by her psychiatrist, had a previous diagnosis of autism as a young child, used short phrases to communicate, and had a diagnosis of mild intellectual disability. The family had recently raised concerns about increases in agitation, disorganized speech, which was different from baseline, and additional odd behavior as if she was seeing things that weren't there. When I spoke with the treating clinician that referred her to me, the individual felt that this was all just part of the autism spectrum disorder. And it really, when we started to talk to the family, it was a failure of the clinician to understand the change in baseline and the unique symptoms were really part of psychosis. So just this idea of thinking, well, all of these different behaviors, these odd behaviors are part of a diagnosis that is a part of the developed disability really led that psychiatrist to not be able to more effectively and quickly treat the individual. We also know there are other barriers to an accurate description of symptoms. Individuals with intellectual disability or language and communication impairments can have difficulty interpreting their internal states or may have difficulty reporting them to others. So we often rely on secondary reporters to communicate symptoms. And we know, think of yourself, your parent, your spouse, whomever, doesn't always know how you're feeling. It's the best we can do. We often see when we ask individuals with disabilities themselves, we can see some self-report biases that we have to think about where they may just agree with everything that we say or they might just pick one response and keep going. So it's definitely not an easy task. So what can we do? Talk about how hard it is. Let's think about what we can do. And it really is watching the individual for changes in behavior. So things that can be red flags are an increase in agitation or energy level or a decrease in energy level. Someone who loses interest in activities that they were previously interested in. Sleep problems, sleeping too much or too little. Weight gain, too much or too little. These really observable symptoms can often be that first warning sign for us. We want to also listen to the individual. Are they reporting feelings such as sadness or feeling tired or grumpy? Are they worried, clingy, things that we might see as being part of an anxiety or a depressive disorder? And tracking their mood. Often there are a number of different team members involved. We can look and see patterns. We can see that an individual has felt like this, decreased energy, decreased appetite, decreased motor level for the last 2 weeks, then we really maybe should be worried about a major depressive disorder. Then after you have this information, then it's really great to reach out to the primary care physician. They can help you work through this process and or request a referral for a mental health evaluation. We want to think about it. We want to think first about recognition. It can be difficult for providers and caregivers to recognize the presentation of mental health. And especially when we think about individuals with disabilities, maybe can't always advocate for their own needs. So that recognition is really a concern. Caregivers and support people play a really important role in helping to identify the changes. They're really the ones that are often the most aware of the individual's pattern and their typical disposition and can see those changes in baseline. And I think it's really important for us to really be paying attention early on. When we talk to mental health providers, they often report a belief that often they see family members are not seeking help until they're not able to manage, until things get to a crisis level. So if we could be able to really get at it early, we can get the individual the help they need before they need emergency services. A model that I like to use when identifying behavior changes is the HELP model. I'm going to walk you through in the next few slides what that means. But when we think about it, this is a model that I'd like everybody to apply when working with a concern. We want to first look and say, okay, is the eating an issue because of a health condition or a medical condition? Have there been changes in the environment? Have the supports changed? Have the expectations changed? What's going on in the individual's life? Have there been new life experiences? Has there been a trauma? Has there been a change in social support? we want to go through all of those things and address each of them and then look at the psychiatric disorder. We also then want to look at the far right-hand side. We need to think of all of this within the context of the individual's strengths, their vulnerabilities, what might have happened to bring things on, and what might be going on to keep these challenges going. So when we think about physical health, we really want to look at medical conditions, hearing or ear infections, how self-injury, irritability if your ear hurts, GI distress, urinary issues, menstrual cramps, all of these things can cause changes in behavior and can be addressed to help make things better for that individual and may help to ameliorate their difficulties. Same thing with dental conditions. Often dental is not always paid attention to closely. There could be cavities or a dental pain that needs to be taken care of. Also things such as thyroid dysfunction, seizures, or vitamin D deficiency. All of these things can be associated with behavioral changes. I also want to look at those environmental factors. Has there been a death or a separation from a parent, a family member, or a caregiver? An important one is a change in support staff or a longtime support person that's no longer involved. This can be very traumatic and feel like a loss to individuals, a roommate change. We also want to look at those expectations to make sure that the family and support staff have appropriate expectations. And does the individual have access to activities and social connectedness, all the things that we know promote positive mental health? Another important piece that we really want to think about is trauma. Research shows that individuals with IDD are at significantly more risk for adverse childhood experiences and other forms of abuse and neglect as compared to the general population. For example, studies have found that individuals with a disability are 4 times more likely to be a victim of crime and 3.4 more times to be neglected. Approximately half will experience 10 or more traumatic events in their life. Another important thing for us to realize is that events can be experienced as traumatic for individuals with IDD, and they may not always be the things that one might think of as traditionally traumatic. This could be such as the loss or the moving away of a staff, undergoing a medical procedure, or even the loss of control in specific situations or with a specific person can be very traumatic for an individual with IDD. There are a number of vulnerabilities on the systemic, personal, and societal level that can increase the risk for traumatic events. Some of them we may not be able to address, but others we can. So we look at those systemic ones. We see high levels of stress within families, and that can be multi-directional and increased risk, as well as a greater reliance on caregivers, sometimes a trained compliance to authority figures. Also think about personal vulnerabilities. If an individual is restricted in their abilities to communicate, not have access to the tools that they need to express their wants and desires, and they may have difficulty predicting high-risk situations and may not always understand that an abusive situation is abusive. I think there are also societal vulnerabilities that we've seen in the literature. An important one is a lower likelihood of education about human sexuality. So we think about things we can address. A number of these on here, stigma, societal assumptions of folks with ID, these are things we can work towards addressing at all of these different levels. So how can providers and support staff support mental health? We know that the use of mental health services does not match the prevalence of mental health. So we really need to work towards identifying the folks that need that treatment. And those folks that are working with them every day can identify those changes in behavior. Be supportive when someone starts talking about referral to services or asking for help. Assist with arranging transportation. That can be a huge barrier for some folks, and making sure that an individual has adequate transportation to their medical appointments and their mental health appointments, and then really involving providers and support staff in therapy as it's appropriate. That psychoeducation and the work on generalizing therapy can be a very powerful tool. And it's important that we get folks to treatment because there is a growing body of literature supporting the benefits of psychotherapy for adults with intellectual disability. We see research supporting dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and mindfulness. Overall, the research base is really rapidly expanding, and we're really starting to understand and realize that individuals with IDD, children and adolescents and adults can benefit from psychotherapy. There was a study that was done by the World Health Organization where they reviewed 92 studies. They found 9 that met the criteria for inclusion in their meta-analysis and basically found that psychotherapy can produce change in at least 2/3 of the measures that they included, those measures of change. This is something we want to make sure we get folks linked with. So once you get someone linked with therapy, what does that mean for us? You should see a clinician that will make recommendations specific to that individual and their mental health needs. That individualized treatment is something that we should be looking for with the clients that we serve. Treatment should be multifaceted. I'm going to think of it as not just medication. Medication can be a very powerful and important tool. However, it's not the only tool. We look at combination of psychotherapy and then behavior support as needed. You should also see with your clinicians recommendations on environmental, educational, and work supports that can help to support that individual's positive mental health and help to reduce relapse. The other thing that can also be very important and is something to advocate for is to have a plan in place for emergency situations so that all the team members can meet the mental health of the needs of the individual when they are in crisis. So you can see it's very important from the recognition phase all the way through to meeting with the clinician that we have this team approach. It's through this team approach that we can really make sure that we're providing that person-centered and integrated care for the adults with intellectual disabilities. So thank you very much. And with that, I will turn it over.
Thank you for listening. This podcast is presented by the Lewin Group and is supported through the Medicare-Medicaid Coordination Office at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. MMCO is dedicated to helping beneficiaries enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid have access to seamless, high-quality healthcare that includes the full range of covered services in both programs. To support providers in their efforts to deliver more integrated, coordinated care, MMCO is developing technical assistance and actionable tools based on successful innovations and care models. To learn more about current efforts and resources, please visit our website, www.resourcesforintegratedcare.com. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is @integrate_care, or follow Resources for Integrated Care on LinkedIn to stay up to date with our recent products and technical assistance.